Part 3. The Fall. She grew old in less than a minute. When Maris left the side of the landsman of Theos, she was still young. She took the underground way from his spare rocky keep to the sea, a damp, gloomy tunnel through the mountain. She walked quickly with a taper in her hand, her folded wings on her back, surrounded by echoes and the slow drip of water. There were puddles on the floor of the tunnel, and the water soaked through her boots. Maris was anxious to be off. It was not until she emerged into the twilight on the far side of the mountain that Maris saw the sky. It was a dim, threatening purple, a violet so dark it was almost black, the colour of a bad bruise, full of blood and pain. The wind was cold and unruly. Maris could taste the fury that was about to break, could see it in the clouds. She stood at the foot of the time-worn stairs that led up the sea cliff, and briefly she considered turning back, resting overnight at the lodge house and postponing her flight until dawn. The thought of the long walk back through the tunnel dismayed her, however, and Maris took no joy in this place. Theos seemed to her a dark and bitter land, and its landsmen rude, his brutality barely hidden beneath the civilities required between landsman and flyer. The message he had given her to fly weighed heavily upon her. The words were angry, greedy, full of the threat of war, and Maris was eager to deliver and forget them, to free herself of the burden as quickly as she could. So she extinguished her taper and started up the stairs, climbing easily with long, impatient strides. There were lines on her face and grey in her hair, but Maris was still as graceful and vigorous as she had been at 20. Where the steps opened onto a broad stone platform above the sea, Maris unfolded her wings. They caught the wind and tugged at her as she snapped the last struts into place. The purple gloom of the storm gave a dark cast to the silver metal, and the rays of the setting sun left red streaks of light upon it, like fresh wounds welling full of blood. Maris hurried. She wanted to get ahead of the storm, to use the front for added speed. She tightened the straps around herself, checked the wings a final time, and wrapped her hands about the familiar grips. With two quick steps, she flung herself from the cliff, as she had uncounted times before. The wind was her old and true lover. She folded herself into its embrace and flew. She saw lightning on the horizon, a lingering three-pronged bolt in the eastern sky. Then the wind slackened and went soft on her. And she fell, and banked, and turned, searching for a stronger current, until the storm hit her, sudden as the crack of a whip. The wind gusted out of nowhere with terrible force, and as she struggled to ride with it, it changed direction. Then a second time, then a third. Rain stung her face, lightning blinded her, and there was a pounding in her ears. The storm pushed her backward, then head over heels, as if she were a toy. She had no more choice, no more chance, than a leaf in a gale. She was buffeted this way and that until she was sick and dizzy and aware that she was falling. And she looked over her shoulder and saw the mountain rushing at her, a sheer wall of slick, wet stone. She tried to pull away and managed only to turn herself in the fierce embrace of the wind. Her left wing brushed the rock, collapsed, and Maris fell sideways, screaming, her left wing limp. Though she tried to fly one-winged, she knew it was useless, and was blinded by the rain. The storm had her in its killing teeth, and with her last clear thought, Maris knew this was her death. The sea took her, and broke her, and spat her out. They found her late the next day, broken and unconscious, but alive, on a rocky beach 3 miles from Theos Flyer's cliff. When Maris woke days later, she was old. She was seldom more than semi-conscious during that first week, and afterward she remembered little. Pain when she moved and when she did not, waking and sleeping. She slept most of the time, and her dreams were as real to her as the constant pain. She walked through long tunnels beneath the earth, walked until her legs ached horribly, but she never found the steps that would lead her out to the sky. She fell through still air endlessly, her strength and skill useless in a windless sky. She stood before hundreds in council and argued, but her words were slurred and too soft, and the people there would not listen. She was hot, terribly hot, and she could not move. Someone had taken her wings and tied her legs and arms. She struggled to move, to speak. She had to fly somewhere with an urgent message. She couldn't move. She couldn't speak. She didn't know if there were tears or rain on her cheeks. Someone wiped her face and made her drink a thick, bitter liquid. At some point, Maris knew she was lying in a big bed, a hearth nearby that always had a blazing fire in it, and she was covered with heavy layers of furs and blankets. She was hot, terribly hot, and she struggled to push off the blankets, but could not. There seemed to be people in the room, coming and going. She recognized some of them. They were her friends, but although she asked them to remove the blankets, they never did. They didn't seem to hear her, but they would often sit at the foot of the bed and talk to her. They spoke of things gone by as if they were present still, which confused her. But everything was confused, and she was glad to have her friends with her. Col came, singing his songs, and Barion was with him, Barion of the quick grin and the deep, rumbly voice. Old crippled Sina sat on the edge of the bed and said nothing. Raven appeared once, dressed all in black and looking so bold and beautiful that her heart ached with unspoken love for him all over again. Garth brought her steaming hot kivas, then told her jokes so that she laughed and forgot to drink. Val Onewing stood in the doorway, watching, cold-faced as ever. Srella, her dear friend, came often, speaking of old times. And Doral, her first love and still a trusted friend, came again and again, his presence a familiar comfort to her through the pain and confusion. Others came as well. Old lovers she had never thought to see again appeared before her to speak, to plead, to accuse, and then vanished, leaving all her questions unanswered. There was chubby blonde Tmar, bringing her gifts he'd carved from stone, and Halland, the singer, strong, black-bearded, looking just as he had when they'd lived together on Lesser Amberley. She remembered then that he had been lost at sea. And she wept, her tears blotting out the sight of him. There was another visitor, a man strange to Maris, and yet he was not a stranger. She knew the touch of his gentle, sure hands, and the sound of his almost musical voice speaking her name. Unlike her other visitors, he came close to her, and held up her head, and fed her hot, milky soups and spiced tea, and a thick, bitter potion that made her sleep. She could not think how or when she had met him, but she felt glad to see him. He was thin and small, but sinewy. Pale skin was stretched taut over the bones and planes of his face, freckled with age. Fine white hair grew well back from a high forehead. His eyes, beneath prominent brows and in a webwork of tiny wrinkles, were brilliantly blue. But although he came so often and knew her, Maris could not bring his name to mind. Once, as he stood beside her and watched her, Maris struggled out of her half-sleep and told him how hot it was and asked him to take away the blankets. He shook his head.
"You're feverish," he said. "The room is chilly and you're very sick. You need the warmth of the blankets."
Startled by this phantom who had finally answered her, Maris struggled to sit up and get a better look at him. Her body responded sluggishly, and a sickening pain seared her left side.
"Easy," said the man.
His cool fingers were on her brow.
Your bones must knit before you can move. Here, drink this.
He lifted her head and pressed the smooth, thick rim of a cup to her lips. She tasted familiar bitterness swallowed obediently. The tension and pain drained out of her as her head sank back on the pillow.
Sleep, and don't worry, said the man.
With difficulty she managed to speak.
Who? My name is Evan, he said. I'm a healer. You've been in my care for weeks now. You are healing, but still very weak. You must sleep now and conserve your strength.
Weeks? The word frightened her. She must be terribly sick, horribly injured, to spend weeks in the house of a healer.
Where?
He put his strong, thin fingers against her mouth to hush her.
On Theos. No more questions now. I'll tell you everything later, when you're stronger. Now sleep. Let your body heal itself.
Maris stopped fighting the coming sleep. He had said she was mending and must conserve her strength. She wished only, as she sank into sleep, that she would not dream again about that brief, terrible flight through the storm and the awful crushing of her body. Later, when she awoke, the world was dark, with only dim embers alive in the hearth to give shape to the shadows. As soon as she stirred, Evan was there. He prodded the fire into new life, felt her brow, and then sat lightly on the bed.
"The fever has broken," he said. "But you are not well yet. I know you want to move. It will be hard to keep still, but you must. You're still very weak, and your body will mend better if you do not tax it. If you cannot keep still by yourself, I must give you more tessis."
Tessis? Her own voice sounded strange in her ears. She coughed, trying to clear her throat.
"The bitter drink that quiets the body and mind brings sleep and relaxation to stop the pain. It's a very helpful drink, full of healing herbs, but too much of it can be a poison. I had to give you more than I like to keep you still. Physical restraints were no good for you. You thrashed and struggled and strained to be free. You wouldn't let the broken parts of your body rest and heal. When you drank the tessis, you fell into the quiet, healing, painless sleep you needed. But I don't want to give you any more. There will be pain, but I think you can bear it. If you cannot, then I will give you tessis. Do you understand me, Maris?"
She looked into his bright blue eyes. "Yes," she said. "I understand. I'll try to be still. Remind me." He smiled. It made his face suddenly young.
"I'll remind you," he said. "You're accustomed to a life of activity, motion, always going and doing. But you can't go somewhere to get your strength back. You must wait for it, lying here as patiently as you can."
Maris began to nod her head, checking it as she felt a dull, straining pain on her left side. "I've never been a patient person," she said.
"No, but I've heard that you're strong. Use that strength to be still, and you may recover."
"You must tell me the truth," Maris said. She watched his face, trying to read the answer there. She felt fear, like a cold poison, moving throughout her body. She longed for the strength to sit up, to check her arms and legs.
"I'll tell you what I know," said Evan.
She felt the fear in her throat and could scarcely speak. The words came in a whisper.
How badly was I hurt?"
She closed her eyes, afraid now to read his face.
"You were terribly battered, but you lived."
He stroked her cheek, and she opened her eyes.
"Both your legs were broken in the fall, the left one in four places. I set them, and they seem to be mending well. Not as quickly as they would if you were younger, but I think you'll walk without a limp again. Your left arm was shattered, with bone protruding through the flesh. I thought I'd have to amputate, but I did not."
He pressed his fingers against her lips and withdrew them. It was like a kiss.
"I cleaned it and used the fire flower essence, and other herbs. You'll have stiffness there a long time, but I don't think there was any nerve damage, so that with time and exercise, I think your left arm will be strong and useful again. You broke 2 ribs when you fell, and you hit your head on the rock. You were unconscious for 3 days in my care. I didn't know if you would ever return.
Only 3 broken limbs, Maris said. An easy landing, after all.
Then she frowned. The message.
Evan nodded.
You repeated it again and again in your delirium, like a chant, determined to deliver it. But you needn't worry. The landsman was informed of your accident, and by now he's sent the same message to the landsman of Thrain by another flyer.
Of course, Maris murmured.
She felt a burden she had not even known she carried lifted from her.
Such an urgent message, Evan said, his voice bitter. It couldn't wait for better flying weather. It sent you out into the storm, to injury. It might have meant your death. The war hasn't come yet, but already they start disregarding human lives.
His bitterness distressed her even more than his talk of war, which merely puzzled her.
Evan, she said gently, the flyer chooses when to fly. The landsmen have no power over us, war or no. It was my eagerness to leave your bleak little island that made me start out despite the weather.
And now my bleak little island is your home for a time.
How long, she asked, how long before I can fly again?
He looked at her without replying.
Mary suddenly feared the worst. My wings, she struggled to rise. Are they lost?
Evan was quick with hands on her shoulders. Be still. His blue eyes blazed.
I forgot, she whispered. I'll be still.
Her whole body throbbed painfully in response to the mild exertion.
Please, my wings?
I have them, he said. He shook his head.
Flyers.
I should have known. I've healed other flyers. I should have hung them over your bed so they would be the first thing you saw. The landsman wanted to take them for repair, but I insisted on keeping them. I'll get them for you.
He vanished into the next room. A few minutes later he returned, carrying her wings in his arms. They were mangled and broken, and did not fold properly. The metallic fabric of the wings themselves was virtually indestructible, but the supporting struts were ordinary metal, and Maris could see that several of them had shattered, while others were bent and twisted grotesquely. The bright silver was crusted with dirt and stained black in places. In Evan's uncertain grasp, they seemed a hopeless ruin. But Maris knew better. They were not lost to the sea. They could be made whole again. Her heart soared to see them. They meant life to her. She would fly again.
Thank you, she said to Evan. She tried not to weep.
Evan hung the wings on the wall beyond the foot of the bed where Maris could see them. Then he turned to her.
It will be longer and harder to repair your body than your wings, he said. Much longer than you will like. It won't be a matter of weeks, but of months. Many months. And even then I can't promise you anything. Your bones were shattered, and the muscles torn. You aren't likely at your age to regain all the strength you once had. You'll walk again, but as for flying,
I will fly. My legs and my ribs and my arm will mend, Maris said quietly.
Yes, given time, I hope they will mend. But that may not be enough.
He came close, and she saw the concern in his face.
The head injury. It may have affected your vision, or your sense of balance.
Stop it, Maris said, please.
Tears leaked from her eyes. It's too soon, Evan said. I'm sorry.
He stroked her cheeks, wiping away the tears.
You need rest and hope, not worry. You need time to grow strong again. You'll put on your wings again, but not before you are really ready. Not before I say you are ready.
A land-bound healer, telling a flyer when to fly, Maris muttered with a mock scowl.
Although she might suffer it,
A time of forced inactivity was not something Maris could enjoy. As the days passed and she began to spend more time awake, she grew restless. Evan was beside her much of the time, coaxing her to eat, reminding her to lie still, and talking to her, always talking, to give her restless mind something to exercise itself on, even though her body must stay motionless. And Evan proved to be a gifted storyteller. He considered himself more an observer of life than a participant, and he had a rather detached outlook and a sharp eye for detail. He made Maris laugh, often. He made her think, and he even managed to make her forget, for minutes at a time, that she was trapped in bed with a broken body. At first, Evan told stories of Theos society, his description so vivid that she could almost see the people. But after a time, his talk turned to himself, and he offered her his own life, as if in exchange for the confidences she had made to him during her delirium. He had been born in the deep woods of Theos, an island on the northern fringe of Easton, 60 years before. His parents were foresters. There had been other families in the forest, other children to play with, but from his earliest years Evan had preferred the time he spent alone. He liked to hide in the brush to watch the shy brown dirt diggers, to hunt out the places where the most beautifully scented flowers and tastiest roots grew, to sit quietly in a small clearing with a chunk of stale bread and tame the birds to come to his hand. When Evan was 16, he fell in love with a travelling midwife. Janny, the midwife, was a small brown woman with a ready wit and a sharp tongue. In order to be near her, Evan appointed himself Janny's assistant. She seemed amused by his interest at first, but soon accepted him. And Evan, his interest sharpened by love, learned a great deal from her. On the eve of her departure, he confessed his love for her. She wouldn't stay, and she wouldn't take him with her, not as lover, not as friend, not even as assistant, although she admitted he had learned well and had a skillful touch. She travelled alone, always, and that was that. Evan continued to practice his new healing skills when Janny had gone. Since the nearest healer lived in Thossey village, a full day's walk from the forest, Evan was soon much in demand. Eventually he apprenticed himself to the healer in Thossey. He might have attended a college of healers, but that would have meant a sea voyage, and the idea of travelling on the dangerous water frightened him as nothing else ever had. When he had learned all she could teach him, Evan returned to the forest to live and work. Although he never married, he did not always live alone. Women sought him out, wives seeking an undemanding lover, travelling women who paused a few days or months in his company, patients who stayed until their passion for him was cured. Maris listened to his soft, mellow voice, and gazing at his face for so many hours that she knew it as well as that of any lover in her past, understood the attraction. The bright blue eyes, the skillful, gentle hands, the high cheekbones and imposing beak of a nose. She wondered, though, what he had felt. Was he as self-contained as he seemed? One day Maris interrupted his story of a family of tree kits he'd recently found to ask, "Didn't you ever fall in love? After Janny, I mean." He looked surprised. "Yes, of course I did. I told you about, but not enough to want to marry someone." "Sometimes I did. With Sry. She lived here with me for almost a year, and we were very happy together. I loved her very much. I wanted her to stay, but she had her own life elsewhere. She wouldn't stay in the forest with me. She left." "Why didn't you go away with her? Didn't she ask you to?" Evan looked unhappy. "Yes, she did. She wanted me to go with her. Somehow it just didn't seem possible."
"You've never been anywhere else?"
"I've traveled all over Theos, whenever there has been need," Evan said rather defensively. "And I lived in Thossey for nearly 2 years when I was younger."
"All Theos is much the same," Maris said, shrugging her good shoulder. There was a twinge in her left, which she ignored.
She was allowed to sit up now, and she was afraid Evan would revoke the privilege if she ever admitted to pain. "Some parts have more trees, some parts have more rocks."
Evan laughed. a very superficial view. To you, all parts of the forest would seem identical.
This was so obvious as to require no comment. Maris persisted.
You've never been off Theos?
Evan grimaced.
Once, he said. There'd been an accident. A boat cracked up against the rocks, and the woman in it had been badly injured. I was taken out in a fishing boat to see her. I got so sick on the journey out that I could scarcely help her.
Maris smiled sympathetically, but she shook her head. How can you know that this is the only place you ever want to live if you've never been anywhere else?
I don't claim to know that, Maris. I might have left, I might have had a very different life, but this is what I've chosen. I know this life. It's mine, for better or worse. It's rather late now to mourn all the opportunities I've missed. I'm happy with my life.
He rose then, ending the conversation.
Now, it's time for your nap.
May I?
You may do whatever you like, as long as you do it lying flat on your back without moving.
Maris laughed and let him help her back down on the bed. She wouldn't admit it, but sitting up had tired her, and it was a welcome relief to rest. The slowness of her body to mend frustrated her, and she didn't understand why, just because a few bones were broken, she should tire so easily. She closed her eyes, listening to the sounds Evan made as he tended the fire and tidied the room. She thought about Evan. She was attracted to him. And of course the circumstances had made for an easy intimacy between them. She had imagined that once she mended, she and Evan might become lovers. She thought better of it now, knowing more of his life. Evan had loved and been left too many times. She liked him too well to want to hurt him, and she knew that she would leave Theos and Evan just as soon as she could fly again. It was better, she decided sleepily, that she and Evan remain only friends. She would have to ignore how much she liked that bright sparkle in his blue eyes, and forget her fantasies about his slim, wiry body and skilled hands. She smiled and yawned and fell asleep, to dream that she was teaching Evan how to fly. The next day, Sweller arrived. Maris was drowsy and half asleep, and at first she thought she was dreaming. The stuffy room suddenly became fresher, full of the clean, sharp scent of sea winds, and when Maris looked up, Sweller was standing in the doorway, wings slung over one arm. For an instant, she looked like the shy, slight girl she had been more than 20 years ago, when Maris had helped teach her to fly. But she smiled then, a self-assured smile that lit her dark, thin face and emphasized the lines that time had left there. And when she came forward, spraying salt water from her wings and wet clothes, the phantom of Sweller the Woodwinger dissolved entirely, and she was Sweller of Veleth, a seasoned flyer and the mother of 2 grown daughters. The 2 women embraced, awkwardly because of the huge cast protecting Maris's left arm, but with fierce emotion.
"I came as soon as I heard, Maris," Sweller said. "I'm sorry you had to be here alone for so long, but communication among flyers isn't what it once was, especially for one-wings. I might not be here now, but I had to fly a message to Big Shotan, and afterward I decided to visit the Eyrie. A strange whim, now that I think about it. It must have been 4 or 5 years since the last time. Corinna was there, fresh from Amberley, and she told me that an Eastern flyer had just brought word of your accident. I left at once. I was so worried."
And she bent down to hug her friend again, the wings almost slipping from her grasp.
"Let me hang them for you," Evan said quietly, stepping forward.
Srella handed them to him with hardly a glance, her attention all for Maris.
How are you?" she asked.
Maris smiled. With her good arm she threw back the blanket, revealing 2 cast-bound legs.
"Broken, as you can see, but mending, or so Evan assures me. My ribs hardly pain me at all now, and I'm sure the casts on these legs are ready to be removed. They itch abominably."
She scowled and pulled a long straw from a vase of flowers on the bedside table. Frowning with concentration, she poked the straw down between flesh and cast. "This helps sometimes, but other times it just makes it worse by tickling.
And your arm?
Maris looked to Evan for the answer.
Don't put me on the spot, Maris, he said. You know as much as I do about it. I think your arm is healing properly, and there hasn't been any more infection. As for your legs, you'll be able to scratch them to your heart's content in a day or two.
Maris gave a small bounce of joy, then caught her breath. She turned pale and swallowed hard. Frowning, Evan stepped toward the bed.
What happened? What hurt you?
Nothing, Maris said quickly. Nothing. I just felt a little sick, that's all. I must have jarred my arm.
Evan nodded, but he did not look satisfied.
I'll make tea, he said, and left the two women alone together.
Now I want your news, Maris said. You know mine. Evan has been wonderful, but healing takes so much time, and I've felt so dreadfully cut off here.
It is a distant place, Srella agreed, and cold.
Southerners thought the whole of the world was cold outside their own archipelago. Maris grinned. It was an old joke between them, and clasped Srella's hand.
Where shall I begin? Srella asked. Good news or bad? Gossip or politics? You're the one who's bedbound, Maris. What would you like to know?
Everything, Maris said. But you can begin by telling me about your daughters. Srella smiled.
Srina has decided to marry Arno, the boy who has the meat pie concession on the docks of Gar. She has the only fruit pie stand, of course. And they've decided to combine their businesses and corner the waterfront pie market.
Maris laughed. It seems a very sensible arrangement.
Srella sighed. Oh, yes, a marriage of convenience, all very businesslike. There's not a speck of romance in her soul. Sometimes I can hardly believe Srina is my daughter.
Marissa has enough romanticism for two.
Has she?
Oh, wandering, in love with a singer. I haven't heard from her in a month.
Evan brought in two steaming mugs of tea, his own special brew, fragrant with white blossoms, and then discreetly vanished.
Any news from the Eyrie? Maris asked.
A little, but none of it good.
Jamish vanished on a flight from Gir to Little Shotan. The flyers fear him lost at sea.
Oh, Maris said. I'm sorry. I never knew him well, but he was said to be a good flyer. His father presided over the flyers' council back when we adopted the academy system.
Srella nodded.
Lori of Veron gave birth, she continued, but the child was sickly and died within the week. She's distraught. Gareth, too, of course. And T'Katin's brother was killed in a storm. He captained a trading ship, you know. They say the storm took the whole fleet. These are hard times, Maris. I've heard they are warring again on the Lomaron.
They may be warring on Theos, too, before very long, Maris said gloomily.
Don't you have any cheerful news?
Srella shook her head.
The Eyrie was not a cheerful place. I got the feeling I was not terribly welcome. One wings never go there, but there I was, violating the last sanctuary of the Flyer-born. It made them all uneasy, though Corina and a few others tried to be polite.
Maris nodded. It was an old story. Tensions between the flyers born to wings and the one wings who had taken theirs in competition had been growing for years. Each year saw more landbound take to the air, and the old flyer families felt more threatened.
How is Val? She asked.
Val is Val, Srella said. Richer than ever, but otherwise he doesn't change. The last time I visited Seatooth, he was wearing a belt of linked metal. I can't imagine what it cost. He works with the woodwingers a lot. They all look up to him. The rest of the time he spends partying in Stormtown with Athen and Damon and Ro and the rest of his one-wing cronies. I hear he's taken up with a land-bound woman on Powit, but I don't think he's bothered to tell Kara. I tried to scold him about it, but you know how self-righteous Val can get.
Maris smiled. Oh, yes, she said.
She sipped at her tea as Srella continued, the talk ranging all over Windhaven. They gossiped about other flyers, spoke of friends and family and places where they both had been, continuing a long-running, far-ranging conversation.
Maris felt comfortable, happy, and relaxed. Her captivity would not last much longer. She would be walking again in a matter of days, and then she could begin to exercise and work out to get back in flying trim, and Srella, her closest friend, was now beside her to remind her of her real life that waited beyond these thick walls and to help her back into it. A few hours later, Evan joined them with plates of cheese and fruit, freshly baked herb bread and eggs, scrambled with wild onions and peppers. They all sat on the big bed and ate hungrily. Conversation, or new hope, had given Maris a ravenous appetite. The conversation turned to politics. "Will there really be a war here?" Srella asked. "What's the cause?"
"A rock," Evan grumbled. "A rock barely a half mile across and 2 miles long. It doesn't even have a name. It sits square in the Therian Strait between Theos and Thrain, and everyone thought it was worthless. Only now they've found iron on it. It was a party from Thrain that found the ore and began working it, and they aren't about to give up their claim. But the rock is marginally closer to Theos than it is to Thrain, so our landsman is trying to grab it. He sent a dozen landsguard to seize the mine, but they were beaten off, and now Thrain is fortifying the rock."
"Theos doesn't seem to have a strong claim," Srella said. "Will your landsman really go to war over it?"
Evan sighed. "I wish I thought otherwise, but the landsman of Theos is a belligerent man and a greedy one. He beat Thrain once before in a fishing dispute, and he's certain he can do it again. He'd rather kill any number of people than compromise."
"The message I was to fly to Thrain was full of threats," Maris offered. "I'm surprised war hasn't broken out already."
"Both islands are gathering allies, arms, and promises," Evan said. "I'm told flyers come and go from the keep every day. No doubt the landsman will press a threat or two on you, Srella, when you leave. Our own flyers, Tia and Jem, haven't had a day's rest for the past month. Jem has carried most of the messages back and forth across the strait, and Tia has carried offers and promises to dozens of potential allies. Luckily, none of them seem interested. Time after time she's come back with refusals. I think it's only that keeping the war at bay."
He sighed again. "But it's only a matter of time," he said, his voice weary, "and there will be much killing before it's all over. I'll be called in to patch up those who can be patched up."
"Ah, it's a mockery. A healer in wartime treats the symptoms without being allowed to talk about healing the actual cause, the war itself, unless he wants to be locked up as a traitor."
"I suppose I should be relieved to be out of it," Maris said, but her voice was reluctant. She didn't feel as Evan did about war. Flyers stayed above such conflicts, just as they skimmed above the treacherous sea. They were neutrals, never to be harmed. Objectively, war was a thing to be regretted, but war had never touched Maris or any of those she had loved, and she could not feel the horror of it deeply. "When I was younger, I could learn a message without even hearing it, really. I seem to have lost the talent. Some of the words I've carried have taken the joy out of flight."
"I know," Srella agreed. "I've seen the results of some messages I've flown, and sometimes I feel very guilty."
"Don't," Maris said. "You're a flyer. You aren't responsible."
"Val disagrees, you know," Srella said. "I argued it with him once. He thinks we are responsible."
"That's understandable," Maris said. Srella frowned at her, uncomprehending.
"Why?"
"I'm surprised he never told you," Maris said. "His father was hanged.
A flyer carried the order for the execution from Lomeron to South Arran. Arrak, in fact."
"You remember Arrak?"
"Too well," Srella said. "Val always suspected Arrak was behind that beating he got. I remember how angry he was when he couldn't find his assailants to prove anything."
She smiled wryly.
"I also remember the party he threw on Seatooth when Arrak died. Black cake and all."
Evan was looking at the two women thoughtfully.
"Why do you carry messages if you feel guilty about them?" he asked Srella.
"Why, because I'm a flyer," Srella said. "It's my job, it's what I do. The responsibility comes with the wings."
"I suppose," Evan said.
He stood and began collecting the empty plates.
I don't think I could take that attitude, frankly. But I'm a landbound, not a flyer. I wasn't born to wings.
Nor were we, Maris started to say, but Evan left the room. She felt a flash of annoyance, but Srella began to talk again. Maris was drawn back into the conversation, and it wasn't very long until she had forgotten what she was annoyed about.
At last it was time for the casts to be cut off. Her legs were to be freed, and Evan promised that it would not be much longer for her arm. Maris cried out at the sight of her legs. They were so thin and pale, so odd-looking. Evan began to massage them gently, washing them with a warm, herb-scented solution, and gently, skillfully kneading the long, unused muscles. Maris sighed with pleasure and relaxed. When at last Evan had done, and he rose and put away the bowl and cloth, Maris thought she would burst with impatience. "Can I walk?" she asked. Evan looked at her, grinning.
"Can you?"
Her heart lifted at the challenge, and she sat up and slipped her legs over the edge of the bed. Srella offered her support, but Maris shook her head slightly, motioning her friend away. Then she stood, on her own 2 feet, without support. But there was something wrong. She felt dizzy and sick. She said nothing, but her face gave her away. Evan and Srella moved closer.
"What's wrong?" Evan asked.
I must have stood up too fast." She was sweating and afraid to move, afraid she would fall or faint or throw up.
"Take it easy," Evan said. "There's no rush."
His voice was warm and soothing, and he took her good arm. Srella offered support on her left side. This time, Maris did not shake them off or try to move alone.
"One step at a time," said Evan.
Leaning on them, guided by them, Maris took her first few steps. She felt mildly nauseated still, and strangely disoriented, but she also felt triumphant. Her legs were working again.
"Can I walk by myself now?"
"I don't know why not." Maris took her first unsupported step, and then her second. Her spirits lifted. It was easy. Her legs were as good as ever. Trying to ignore the uneasiness in her stomach, Maris took her third step, and the room tilted sideways. Her arms flailed, and she stumbled, seeking level ground in the suddenly shifting room, and then Evan caught hold of her.
"No," she cried. "I can do it."
He helped her back on her feet and steadied her. "Let me go, please." Maris drew a shaky hand across her face and looked around. The room was calm and still. The floor as flat as it had ever been. Her legs held up firmly. She took a deep breath and began to walk again. The floor suddenly slipped out from under her feet and would have hit her in the face had not Evan caught her again.
"Srella, hand me the basin," he said.
"I'm fine. I can walk. Let me do it." But then she couldn't speak because she had to throw up, and blessedly Srella was holding a basin before her face. Afterward, shaky but feeling better, Maris walked back to the bed with Evan's guidance.
"What's wrong?"
Maris asked him. He shook his head, but he looked uneasy.
"Maybe just too much exertion too soon," he said.
He turned away.
"I have to go now and tend a colicky baby. I'll be back in an hour or so. Don't try to get up until I return."
She was elated when Evan removed the cast from her arm, overjoyed that the arm proved whole and strong with no permanent damage. She knew she would have to work hard at building up the muscles before she could fly again, but the idea of long, hard hours of exercise excited rather than dismayed her after so much time spent doing nothing. Too soon, Srella announced that she had to leave. A runner had come from the landsman of Theos. "He has an urgent message for North Arran," she told Maris and Evan, making a disgusted face, "and his own flyers are off on other missions. But it is time I left anyway. I must get back to Veleth." They were gathered around the rough wooden table in Evan's kitchen, drinking tea and eating bread and butter as a farewell breakfast. Maris reached across the table and took Srella by the hand.
"I'll miss you," she said, "but I'm glad you came."
"I'll return as soon as I can," Srella said, "though I expect they'd keep me busy. Anyway, I'll spread the word about your recovery. Your friends will be relieved to hear."
"Maris hasn't entirely recovered," Evan said quietly.
"Oh, that's only a matter of time," Maris said cheerfully. "By the time everyone hears from Srella, I'll probably be flying again."
She didn't understand Evan's gloom. She'd expected his spirits to lighten with her own when her arm came out of the cast.
"I may meet you in the sky before you get back here."
Evan looked at Srella.
"I'll walk you to the road," he volunteered.
"You needn't bother," she said. "I know my way.
I'd like to see you off."
Maris stiffened at something undefined in his tone. "Say it here," she said quietly. "Whatever it is, you may as well tell me."
"I've never lied to you, Maris," Evan said.
He sighed, and his shoulders slumped, and Maris suddenly saw him as an old man. Evan leant back in his chair, but looked steadily into Maris's eyes.
"Haven't you wondered about the dizziness you feel when you stand or sit or turn too suddenly?"
"I'm still weak. I have to be careful, that's all," Maris said, already defensive.
"My limbs are sound."
"Yes, yes. We need have no worries about your legs or your arm."
"But there is something else wrong with you.
Something that can't be reset, splinted, and allowed to heal.
I think something happened when you hit your head on the rock. There was some damage inside, to your brain. It affected your sense of balance, your depth perception, perhaps your vision. I'm not sure what exactly. I know so little, no one knows much."
"There's nothing wrong with me," Maris said in a reasonable tone of voice. "I was dizzy and weak at first, but I'm getting better. I can walk now, you have to admit that, and I'll be able to fly again."
"You are learning to adjust, to compensate, that's all," Evan said. "But your sense of balance was affected. You will probably learn to adjust to life on the ground, but in the air. An ability you need in the air may be gone now. I don't think you can learn to fly without it. So much depends on your sense of balance.
What do you know about flying? How can you tell me what I need to fly?"
Her voice was as hard and cold as ice.
"Maris," whispered Srella.
She tried to catch Maris's hand, but the injured woman pulled away.
"I don't believe you," Maris said. "There's nothing wrong with me that won't heal. I will fly again. I'm just a little sick, that's all. Why should you assume the worst? Why should I?"
Evan sat still, thinking. Then he rose and went to the corner by the back door where the firewood was kept. Separate from the logs and kindling were some long flat boards, leftover lumber that Evan cut up to use as splints. He selected one, about 6 feet long, 7 inches wide, and 2 inches thick, and laid it down on the bare boards of the kitchen floor. He straightened up and looked at Maris.
"Can you walk along this?"
Maris raised her eyebrows in mocking surprise. Absurdly, her stomach was tight with nerves. Of course she could do it. She couldn't imagine failing such a test. She rose from her chair slowly, one hand gripping the table edge. She walked across the floor smoothly, not too slowly. The floor did not slip or buckle beneath her as it had that first day. Absurd to say there was anything wrong with her sense of balance. She wouldn't fall on level ground, and she wouldn't fall from a 2-inch height.
"Shall I hop on one foot?" she asked Evan.
"Just walk along it normally."
Maris stepped upon the plank. It wasn't quite wide enough to stand normally, feet side by side, so she had to take a second step at once, with no time for consideration. She remembered high cliff ledges she had skipped along as a child, some with paths narrower than this board. The board wobbled and shifted beneath her feet. Despite herself, Maris cried out as she felt herself falling to one side. Evan caught her.
"You made the board move," she said in sudden fury. But the words sounded petulant and childish in her ears.
Evan only looked at her. Maris tried to calm herself.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I didn't mean that. Let me try again."
Silently, he let go of her and stepped back.
Tense now, Maris stepped up again and walked 3 steps. She began to waver. 1 foot went over the side onto the floor. She cursed and pulled it back, and took another step, and felt the board shift again. Again she missed it. She lifted her foot back onto the board and took another step forward, and lurched to one side, falling. Evan did not catch her that time. She hit the floor on hands and knees, and jumped up, her head spinning from the exertion. Maris, enough! Evan's firm, gentle hands were on her, pulling her away from the treacherous plank. Maris could hear Srella weeping softly.
All right, Maris said. She tried to keep the anguish out of her voice. There's something wrong.
All right, I admit it. But I'm still healing. Give me time. I will get well. I will fly again.
In the morning, Maris began exercising in earnest. Evan brought her a set of stone weights, and she began working out regularly. She was dismayed to find that both her arms, not merely the injured one, were sadly weakened by her time of enforced idleness. Determined to test the air again as soon as possible, Maris had her wings taken to the keep, to the landsman's own metalsmith, for repair. The woman was busy with preparations for the impending war, but a flyer's request was never to be ignored, and she promised to have the damaged struts straightened and restored within a week. She was true to her word. Maris checked out her wings carefully on the day they were returned, folding and unfolding each strut in turn, scanning the fabric to make sure it was taut and firmly mounted. Her hands fell to the task as if they'd never stopped doing it. They were a flyer's hands, and there was nothing in all the world they knew how to do better than tend a pair of wings. Almost, Maris was tempted to strap on the wings and make the long walk to the flyer's cliff. Almost, but not quite. Her balance had not yet come to her, she thought, though she was steadier on her feet now. Every night, surreptitiously, she gave herself the plank test. She had not yet passed it, but she was improving. She was not yet ready for wings, but soon. Soon. When she was not working, sometimes she walked with Evan in the forest, when he went abroad to gather herbs or tend to other patients. He taught her the names of the plants he used in his work, and explained what each herb was good for, and when and how to use it. He showed her all manner of animals as well. The beasts of the chilly eastern forests were not at all like the familiar denizens of Lesser Amberley's tame woods, and Maris found them fascinating. Evan seemed so at home in the forest that the creatures did not fear him. Strange white crows with scarlet eyes accepted breadcrumbs from his fingers, and he knew the hidden entrances to the tunnel monkey lairs that honeycombed the wild. And once he caught her arm and pointed out a hooded torturer, gliding sensuously from limb to limb in pursuit of some unseen prey. Maris told him stories of her adventures in the sky and on other islands. She had been flying for more than 40 years, and her head was full of wonders. She told him of life on Lesser Amberley, of Stormtown with its windmills and its wharves, of the vast blue-white glaciers of Artelia, and the fire mountains of the Embers. She talked of the loneliness of the outer islands, hard up against the endless ocean to the east, and the fellowship that had once thrived on the Eyrie before flyers had divided into factions. Neither ever spoke of what lay between them, dividing them. Evan did not contradict Maris when she spoke of flying, nor did he mention any invisible damage to her head. The subject was like a patch of dangerous ground, no wider than a wooden plank, upon which neither was willing to step. Maris kept her occasional dizzy spells to herself. One day, as they stepped outside Evan's house, Maris stopped him from turning deeper into the forest. "All those trees make me feel like I'm still inside," she complained. "I need to see the sky, to smell clean, open air. How far away is the sea?" Evan gestured to the north.
"About 2 miles that way.
You can see where the trees begin to thin." Maris grinned at him.
"You sound reluctant.
Do you feel sad when there aren't any trees around? You don't have to come if you can't bear it. But I don't understand how you can breathe in that forest. It's too dim and close. Nothing to smell but dirt and rot and leaf mould.
Wonderful smells, Evan said, smiling back. They began to walk toward the north.
The sea is too cold and empty and big for my tastes. I feel comfortable and at home in my forest.
Ah, Evan, we're so different, you and I. She touched his arm and grinned at him, somehow pleased by the contrast. She threw her head back and sniffed the air.
Yes, I can smell the sea already.
You could smell it on my doorstep. You can smell the sea all over Theos, Evan pointed out.
The forest disguised it. Maris felt her heart lightening with the thinning of the forest. All her life had been spent beside the sea or over it. She had felt the lack every morning, waking in Evan's house, missing the pounding of the waves and the sharp salt smell, but most of all missing the sight of that vast grey immensity beneath an equally immense and turbulent sky. The tree line ended abruptly, and the rocky cliffs began. Maris broke into a run. She stopped on the cliff's edge, breathing hard, and gazed out over the sea and the sky. The sky was indigo, filled with rapidly scudding grey clouds. The wind was relatively gentle at this height, but Maris could tell from the patient circling of a pair of scavenger kites that up higher the flying was still good. Not a day for rushing urgent messages, perhaps, but a good day for playing, for swooping and diving and laughing in the cool air. She heard Evan approaching.
"You can't tell me that's not beautiful," she said without turning. She took another step closer to the edge of the cliff and looked down and felt the world drop beneath her. She gasped for breath and her arms flailed, seeking some solidity, and she was falling, 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 and even Evan's arms, wrapped tight around her, could not draw her back to safety.
It stormed all the next day. Maris spent the day inside, lost in depression, thinking of what had happened on the cliffs. She did not exercise. She ate listlessly, and had to force herself to tend to her wings. Evan watched her in silence, frowning often. The rain continued the following day, but the worst of the storm was past, and the downpour grew more gentle. Evan announced that he was going out.
"There are some things I need from Port Theos," he said. "Herbs that do not grow here. A trader came in last week, I understand. Perhaps I will be able to replenish my stores."
"Perhaps," Maris said evenly. She was tired, though she had done nothing this morning except eat breakfast. She felt old.
"Would you like to walk with me? You've never seen Port Theos."
"No," Maris said. "I don't feel up to it just now. I'll spend the day here."
Evan frowned, but reached for his heavy rain cloak nonetheless. "Very well," he said. "I will be back before dark."
But it was well after dark when the healer finally returned, carrying a basket full of bottled herbs. The rain had finally stopped. Maris had begun to worry about him when the sun went down.
"You're late," she said when he entered and shook the rain from his cloak.
"Are you all right?"
He was smiling.
Maris had never seen him quite so happy.
"News! Good news," he said. "The port is full of it. There will be no war. The landsmen of Theos and Thrain have agreed to a personal meeting on that accursed rock to work out a compromise about mining rights."
"No war," Maris said, a little dully.
"Good, good. Odd, though. How did it happen?"
Evan started a fire and began to make some tea.
"Oh, it was all happenstance," he said. "Tia returned from another mission bearing nothing. Our landsman was rebuffed on all sides. Without allies, he did not feel strong enough to press his claims. He's furious, I'm told, but what can he do? Nothing. So he sent Jem to Thrain to set up a meeting, to haggle out whatever settlement he can. Anything is better than nothing. I would have thought he'd find support on Cheslin or Thrinel, particularly if he offered them a large enough share of the iron. And certainly there was no love lust between Thrain and the Arryns," Evan laughed. "Ah, what does it matter? The war is off. Port Theos is giddy with relief.
except for a few Landsguard who'd hoped to weigh down their pockets with iron. Everyone's celebrating, and we should celebrate too.
Evan went to his basket and rummaged among the herbs, pulling out a large moonfish.
"I thought perhaps seafood would cheer you up," he said. "I know a way of cooking this with dandyweed and bitternuts that will make your tongue sing."
He found a long bone knife and began to scale the fish, whistling happily as he worked, and his mood was so infectious that Maris found herself smiling too. There was a loud knocking at the door. Evan looked up, scowling.
"An emergency, no doubt," he said, cursing. "Answer it if you would, Maris. My hands are full of fish."
The girl standing in the door wore a dark green uniform trimmed with grey fur, a Landsguard, and one of the landsman's runners.
"Maris of Lesser Amberley?" she asked.
"Yes," Maris said.
The girl nodded. "The landsman of Theos sends his greetings and invites you and the healer Evan to honor him at dinner tomorrow night, if your health permits it."
"My health permits it," Maris snapped.
"Why are we suddenly so honored, child?"
The runner had a seriousness beyond her years.
"The landsman honors all flyers, and your injury in his service has weighed heavily on him. He wishes to show his gratitude to all the flyers who have flown for Theos, however briefly, in the emergency just passed."
"Oh," Maris said. She still was not satisfied. The landsman of Theos had not struck her as the type who cared much about expressing gratitude. "Is that all?" The girl hesitated. Briefly, her detachment left her, and Maris saw that she was indeed very young.
"It's not part of the message, flyer, but..."
"Yes," Maris prompted. Evan had stopped his work to stand behind her. "Late this afternoon, a flyer arrived with a message for the landsman's ears only. He received her in private chambers. She was from Western, I think. She dressed funny, and her hair was too short."
"Describe her if you can," Maris said. She took a copper coin from a pocket and let her fingers play with it.
The girl looked at the coin and smiled.
"Oh, she was a Westerner. Young, 20 or 25. Her hair was black, cut just like yours. She was very pretty. I don't think I've ever seen anyone as pretty. She had a nice smile, I thought, but the lodgemen didn't like her. They said she didn't even bother thanking them for their help. Green eyes. She was wearing a choker. 3 strands of colored sea glass. Is that enough?"
"Yes," Maris said. "You're very observant." She gave the girl the coin.
"You know her?" Evan asked. "This flyer?"
Maris nodded. "I've known her since the day she was born. I know her parents as well."
"Who is she?"
he demanded impatiently.
"Corina," said Maris, "of Lesser Amberley."
The runner remained at the door. Maris glanced back at her.
"Yes?" she asked. "Is there more?"
"We accept the invitation, of course. You may give the landsman our thanks."
"There's more," the girl blurted. "I forgot. The landsman said, most respectfully, that you are requested to bring your wings, if that would not put too great a burden on your health."
"Of course," Maris said numbly. "Of course." She closed the door.